Greetings to everybody who's on the phone. This is Elaine Larson, and I'm very pleased to introduce today Dr. Don Goldman, MD. He's the Chief Medical and Scientific Officer at the Institute for Healthcare Improvement, IHI. Dr. Goldman supports IHI's content leads to identify innovative approaches, cutting-edge developments, and expert faculty in areas of strategic focus, using his external relationships to identify important or emerging gaps in IHI content, particularly with regard to innovations and evidence-based interventions that emerge from academia. He also works to ensure the rigor of IHI's results-oriented work and to disseminate these results in presentations at national meetings and peer-reviewed publications. He also serves as senior lead for the IHI Fellowship Program and mentors emerging investigators at Harvard Medical School, Boston Children's Hospital, and the Harvard School of Public Health. We're delighted to welcome Don and pleased that after many, many years and decades, he's still contributing significant things to the field, and we're looking forward to a very exciting talk. So, Don?
That's great. Thank you, Elaine. Elaine and I have known each other for quite a while and have had some memorable dinners together. I do appreciate the fact that I'm old, but still vigorous, and so that's the...
Now, I didn't mean that because I'm... You're right. Moving
let's
forward.
Put it this way. For those of you who aren't in the United States, I'm receiving Social Security, which is our idea of
Well, a lot of people think
just doing PDSA cycles, which means rapid cycle testing on the pathway to implementation of new ideas or evidence-based practices. And PDSA cycles are critical for improvement, but it's not the entire story, and I'll go into that in a few minutes. Neither is it just having a collaborative, and the usual term that's used is a breakthrough series collaborative in which a number of organizations get together to accelerate improvement, especially when the evidence-based practices they're trying to act on are straightforward and not too complex or multifaceted. I'll just note that this is a method. It's a tool. It's not the science itself. It's just a way of implementing the science. Having just collaborated on a systematic review of all of the studies of these kinds of collaboratives, I can tell you the evidence is mixed, and the evidence is mixed in part because people don't really do the science rigorously. They set up this collaborative and they think that's it, it's magic, improvement will occur, but in fact there's a science behind it that has to be pushed forward. Next slide, please. So the science of improvement, and I have animated slides, so for those of you who don't have the actual slide set, you're going to see the whole slide at once, but this is what I think the science improvement is, stripped to its bare essentials. First of all, it began in the 1950s with a long background, and I always kid the people here who have developed and promulgate the science because they have it going all the way back to Plato, which, I mean, that's nice for those of you historians, but in a way it feels a little arrogant to me, but that's what they say. That information, that learning was incorporated by Deming, who you probably have heard of in this book called The New Economics, into something that Deming called profound knowledge. And I actually hate to show the slide because I think people immediately tune out and go to sleep, but I do think it's important to have some idea of where all this came from. And so in 1 minute here, I'm going to tell you what this is. It's got four key aspects. First, it appreciates that we are working in systems. And I don't need to tell any of you or improvement that knowing about systems is absolutely key. Secondly, it asks, how do we know? What's the theory of knowledge? The technical term is epistemology. How do we know that what we're seeing actually is true? Because if we aren't sure that we've learned something, then how can we be credible? So being sure that we know what we think we know is very important. Thirdly, psychology. And these days when we talk about psychology, it's really the behavioral sciences and social sciences. It's much broader than when Deming described this when he was thinking of developmental psychology. We now know behavioral economics is important. There's a whole variety of behavioral change theories and practice that we need to know. And finally, understanding variation. Much of quality improvement springs from a appreciation of variation. So this may be variation over time. We notice that our results or the way in which we adhere to processes of care are varying over time, and we need to understand, is that just random variation or is there something special happening here? In infectious diseases, we always are thinking, is this an epidemic or is this something that's going on all the time? Is it endemic? So understanding that variation over time, very important. Also, understanding variation between and among people is important, or among institutions is important. And we know, based on a lot of work, very scholarly work, that one state in the United States may do five times the cesarean deliveries as another state in the United States. Recently, just yesterday, in fact, I was shown 2010 data from England, which looked at variation in the use of various cardiovascular procedures like stents. And again, the variation was eightfold across various regions in England. So understanding that variation and what it tells you about opportunities for improvement is extremely important. So this profound knowledge needed some translation, because not everybody wants to sit around and talk about developmental psychology and profound knowledge. This is the improvement guide that I've put here. And that's a book that was written by the founders of the Institute for Healthcare Improvement. And there's not much in here that you can't find in other sources, but it's a particularly good synthesis of the information you need to improve. And boiled down to its simplest is this so-called model for improvement. And this looks deceptively simple, and I can't tell you how many slides I've seen where somebody puts up the model for improvement and everybody thinks, oh, wow, that's so easy, let's just go out and do it. But when you think about it, let's look at the questions here. The first question is, what are we trying to accomplish? Well, I've seen countless quality improvement projects where the aim, the goal, was not well specified. Was the goal to engage people? Was the goal to have them learn something? Was the goal to get them to change their behavior? Was the goal to improve an outcome? If so, what outcome, over what time period, and by how much? And that gets to the second question. How will we know that change is an improvement? Basically, if you don't have a measurement framework for what you're trying to improve, then how do you know that what you've done hasn't just been a waste of time? So, again, setting up a practical measurement framework that can be incorporated into the work you really do, not necessarily hiring a data person or hiring another nurse, but incorporating your work so you can measure whether or not you're improving, that's absolutely critical. And then finally, this plan, do, study, act. How do we know that, what can we try, what can we change that could result in improvement? And the biggest mistake I see here tends to be in academia. When people look at this, and I've seen this again countless times, they say, we'll plan for 3 months, we'll run something for 3 months, we'll study it for 3 months, and then for the next 3 months, we'll decide what to do next. And that takes a year. What a PDSA cycle really should be is something you can do almost immediately. It may be in the next three patients you see. And that's absolutely critical. I'll give you an example. So I used to be the chief, along with a nurse leader, of a adolescent medicine ward at Boston Children's Hospital, where we cared for a lot of patients with chronic diseases like cystic fibrosis. And we looked at our that said that the patients on my unit did not know who their doctor was. Very poor rating. So we want to verify that. Is that really true? So we went around, we asked 10 patients, not 1,000 patients, but 10 patients, do you know who your doctor is? And one of 10, only one of the 10, knew who their doctor was. And there were a lot of reasons why they don't know their doctor, but they didn't know who their doctor was. So we said, well, what can we test? And I got together with the residents, the trainees, junior doctors, and I said, let's get a script. What can you say when you go in the room that'll help the patient? And so the script went something like this. I don't remember it exactly, but it was, my name is John Smith. I am your resident physician. That means I am in training here under close supervision, but I've been to medical school, I'm well trained, and I will know from minute to minute, hour to hour, everything that's going on with your care. So I'm John Smith, I'm your resident. Your private physician, your personal physician while you're here, is Nancy Jones. Nancy Jones is the person to whom I report and who reviews my work to ensure that because I'm a trainee, what we're doing is according to the best possible evidence and respects your own preferences. So again, that's Nancy Jones, and she's your attending private physician while you're here. Is that clear? Do you have any questions for me? And then we did that for a week, 1 week, and we went back and did another survey of 10 patients, not 1,000. We didn't get a database and have to use SAS and SPSS. And 9 out of 10 patients knew who their doctor was. So we made that part of our routine and monitored to make sure it was still useful going down the road. So that's the kind of testing I'm talking about. So if we can go now to the next slide, you're all going to be confused by the terminology. So I'm talking about the science of improvement. But you'll also read a lot, depending on where you're working, about implementation science. And in fact, implementation science is now the official language of the U.S. government. You'll also see healthcare delivery science. If you're working with WHO or you're working with the World Bank and Jim Kim, you'll be seeing something about healthcare delivery science. If you're working in resource-poor settings with a public health flavor, you'll see a lot about health system strengthening. And finally, there's this big umbrella term, health services research. I actually don't care what you call it. As long as the basic principles that are incorporated in that model for improvement that I just described are in play. Even if you're using Lean or Six Sigma, again, you're going to have an aim, you're going to have to measure, and you're going to have to test and learn. And what you're doing and testing and learning ought to be on the causal pathway from the changes you're making to the results you want to achieve. Next slide. So here now, based on what I've said so far, is a synopsis of the key attributes of improvement science. And if you remember nothing else and you don't read that book and you don't want to study Plato, just look at these bullets. First, have clear measurable aims and a measurement framework. Have a clear description of the ideas or the content and how these ideas are expected to impact results. And that's really important. If the ideas, if the content, if the changes you're making aren't evidence-based, and don't have a reasonable causal pathway to getting results, then your ideas and content probably aren't really well-honed. I'd like to see everyone have a conceptual model or a logic model or something as simple as a driver diagram. I'm not going to have time to go into driver diagrams today, but basically they display the 3 or 4 highly leveraged main drivers of the results you want to achieve. Sometimes it's really simple. So if I want to lose weight, imagine to yourselves now privately what the 2 key drivers are for me losing weight. Well, I know we can't chat about this, but trust me, it's calories in and calories out. Behind those primary drivers of calories in, calories out, are some secondary drivers such as exercise, what I eat, whether or not I drink Coca-Cola diet or Coca-Cola full bore full of 120 calories. And as you begin to do that, you say, well, how do I measure this? I measure how much I weigh. I can do BMI or weight or whatever. How do I measure calories in and calories out? How do I measure whether or not I'm drinking Diet Coke or regular Coke, whether I'm going to the gym 3 times a week? So you can see you begin to get a logical framework, a causal pathway from stuff I may try and do, like going to the gym twice a week and driving through to the better, more fit, useful me. Then there's respect for the complexity of systems, and we've talked about that. And systems are complex, and it's best to try and really understand the key components of the system you're working in. What are those key components? Where are decisions made in that system? Where are the critical control points or those key points that if you adhere to best practice, you're likely to get good results at the end of the system? Those are the key points that you have to try and get reliable at accomplishing. and measuring and monitoring whether or not you're accomplishing what you hope to accomplish. I know I'm going fast, but I think you can picture in your mind a process diagram that shows the system for Don Goldman losing some weight and where I have to monitor, monitoring the number of times a week I actually went to the gym, whether or not I stayed there my 30 minutes or my 60 minutes, whether or not I had one glass of wine or two glasses of wine. You could, I'm sure, draw a system for any problem that you're trying to improve personally. And in fact, I strongly recommend you work on a personal improvement project so that you get some of these things in play. If we have time, and Elaine reminds me, I'll tell you about an actual personal improvement project I tried at work that used some of these methods. As I said, learning from variation and heterogeneity, using behavioral science, and most important is displaying your data over time, time-ordered data. This is not a before-after science. It is perfectly possible for you to run an improvement project and say, before we started, the death rate was 15%. After we started, the death rate was 10%. And to claim, oh, what we did improved things. If you were to display that on a time-ordered data plot, let's say mortality every quarter or mortality every month, it's entirely possible, and in fact, I've seen this in my own work, that mortality rates have been improving continuously, month on month, quarter on quarter, year on year, with no change in the slope, no change in the rate of improvement at all when the big improvement initiative was launched. In other words, the secular trend, or what was going on in the background, already was driving down mortality rates, and your big million-dollar initiative had nothing to do with the continual improvement. Before or after, it would have been extremely misleading. Now, on the next slide, I want to make the point that rigorous and even publishable QI is available, is possible, almost anywhere. I've given you the website for some guidelines that will help you determine what kinds of components you ought to consider in writing up a quality improvement project. And as you read these, you'll see right away that they are almost unachievable. If you were to write a paper according to those guidelines, it would be very long and probably hard to publish. So look at them more as a menu of things that you ought to think about when you're designing your work and trying to write it up for publication. I should note that these will be radically revised because people have found them hard to apply in practice, and that meeting will be occurring here at IHI next week. So look for Squire Guidelines version 2.0 in the relatively near future. Next slide, please. So now I'm going to talk about personal experience. And those of you who've been on these calls before may have heard some of these examples in the past, but I think they're important here to see the kind of work I've done in my professional career that will lead to the tips I want to give you at the end of the talk. And Elaine, I should add, feel free to interrupt me. If you think I'm being unclear or gliding over some point that the audience is almost certainly not going to get because you're not getting it, just yell out, okay?
So far, so good.
Okay, well, at least not so far, not bad. It may be more accurate, but let's keep moving. So, next slide. If they can do it in Bogota, then perhaps we can do it in our own setting. And I'm going to talk about a project that was designed to reduce post-cesarean infections. Now, I want to tell you, when this project was done, it was done on a shoestring. It was funded by a very small grant to an infectious disease fellow, really small, and through a lot of volunteer work by an obstetrician who was interested in working in resource-limited settings, and by the fellow who wanted to get their first academic publication, and by me, because I wanted to show that you could actually do real improvement work under adverse circumstances. So, suffice it to say that at these two hospitals that delivered thousands and thousands of babies in kind of a resource-poor safety net setting, a lot of bad infections were occurring post-cesarean, and both endometritis and frank wound infections. So there was a lot of will on the part of the staff of these hospitals to do something about what was obvious in their face, a really bad problem. So did we give them, next slide please, Did we give them a 5-month training program on profound knowledge? Did we say you must read Langley and Nolan's Model for Improvement book before we start? Did we tell them that they had to go to the Institute for Healthcare Improvement's Open School, which I hope you all know about the Open School. Let me just pause for a second. If you go to IHI.org, there's a whole section on the Open School. And the Open School for students and their faculty is free and now contains, I believe, 20 different modules on quality and safety, including the ability to take a certain number of these courses and get a certificate. There are now more than 500 chapters of the Open School around the world, and I believe something like 150,000 people have registered, and 1 million courses have just been completed. So please take a look there. At any rate, we didn't require any of that. We had a bunch of busy people working in a very resource-poor setting at a time, by the way, that the Medellin, the cartel, was causing violence. I was driven around in a armored vehicle. The brother of my host had been kidnapped. So you can imagine what this is like. Not a lot of money, a lot of violence, very turbulent. And all we did was we asked the team, would you please just on Post-its or on the blackboard, would you just write down the things you think cause these infections? And you can see what they wrote down. It boiled down to 5 buckets. In other words, most of these changes had close affinity to each other, and you could put them in a domain or in a bucket. And there are perioperative prophylaxis and skin preparation and surgical technique and peripartum events and the always present host and antenatal factors that these women brought with them to the pregnancy and the delivery. And within each of these buckets, you can see some specific subcategories like the dose of the antibiotic, the method of the surgical prep, and so forth. So we'll go to the next slide now. Keep that in mind. So the first thing I got back when we were talking about this, they wanted to know, well, this antibiotic stuff, does it really reduce infections? What's the evidence? And you've got to be ready with the evidence. These are 5 meta-analyses of the use of antibiotic prophylaxis and elective and emergent surgery from across the globe. There didn't happen to be any study from Colombia, but there were others from Latin America, from Europe, from India, wherever. And for those of you who know the statistics here, an odds ratio of 1 means no effect. Anything less than that is the amount of impact that antibiotics had on the infection rate. The vertical lines that are in a sort of purple color, at least on my computer, those are the confidence intervals around the estimate. And if they don't cross 1, it means it's highly statistically significant. So, first of all, they got to learn what an odds ratio was. But beyond that, anybody looking at this would immediately intuit that antibiotics are really, really effective at reducing infections if they're given properly. So they said, wow, we buy that evidence. Thank you very much, team. Next slide. Then how do you decide what to work on? And this is a priority matrix. And I found when I talk about stuff like this, very few people have ever used a priority matrix at work or even more importantly in their own life. How do you decide what to do in what sequence? So this is very simple. We have the importance and what they thought, how effective it would be to reduce infection. Is it something within their capacity in their hospital that they can actually improve? Or they have to go out to the community and get all kinds of other resources? And is it something they can do soon, or would it take a long time? And when they were thinking about the time frame, they also thought about, would it be very expensive? So you can develop whatever priority matrix you want. In general, there are 4 or 5 columns. And then you say, well, which of these 5 domains do we want to work on first? So you'll see that they thought antibiotic prophylaxis, they'd seen the evidence, was very important. And they thought they could do it themselves and that it wouldn't take long to do it. So they decided they'd start with antibiotic prophylaxis, and they were aware that when they did that, they might get to work on some of these other things, but they didn't want to work on antenatal factors, even though they were important, because it wasn't in their control, and it would take a very long time. So antibiotic prophylaxis it was. So if you could skip the next slide and go to the one that says utilization and timing of antibiotic prophylaxis, in Hospital A, only 70% got the antibiotics at all, and only 31% got it at the proper time. In Hospital B, it was reversed. Nobody would celebrate these results. And so we said, well, okay, what's the system that's getting these not so great results? And here's what they drew. And by the way, we didn't ask the surgeons to meet with us at noontime because they're busy in the operating room. So we went to people wherever they were, whatever time we could catch them, and put together this diagram. So you can see what goes on here. You're performing a cesarean delivery. The question is, do you or do you not prescribe prophylaxis? Remember, most people don't get it. If the answer is no, that's no. If the answer is yes, then the doctor writes a prescription. It's taken to the pharmacy. Unfortunately, the pharmacy doesn't always have the antibiotic in stock because every obstetrician has a different regimen. Some of them are using a drug donated by Eli Lilly, and others are using the cheapest drug they can find. The pharmacy can't stock all that. It's chaos. And so sometimes the answer is, no, we don't have that antibiotic. The doctor writes another prescription. The family goes outside the hospital to a truck, buys it from a street vendor, and somehow has to get it to the delivery suite. And you can imagine how that ends, not in a timely administration of antibiotic. So they revise the system, and here it is. So now the doctor writes a prescription, but the prescription has a default. If the patient's allergic to penicillin, they get clindamycin. If the patient is not allergic to penicillin, they get ceftazolin. Both are cheap generic drugs. The drug is available where the prescription's written. They don't have to send it off to some remote part of the hospital. And the nurse puts the drug in the packet of supplies going to the OR, and it goes with the patient, and then it's delivered in a timely fashion if all goes well. And on the next slide, you can see the results. Now, this is a fancy analysis. It's a time series, multivariable analysis. You know, it's probably something you may not want to do every day, but that was what we did with the help of a statistician who was interested in this time-ordered display of data. The open circles are whether or not an antibiotic was given, and that improved very quickly. Don't pay attention, by the way, to the period one, period two for the purpose of this. Just, it's too much detail. But you can see that getting the drug improved pretty quickly. The open squares, it took longer to get the drug delivered on time, but eventually both of those reached close to 100% reliability in that revised system. And then the infection rate, which is the solid diamond, fell quite dramatically by more than twofold over the time period associated with the improvement in practice. And this got published in the Archives of Internal Medicine with the fellow as the first author. And notice the fellow, the junior fellow, is a first author on that paper, and I'll come back to that. Now, fancy statistical analysis data are analyzed in a time-ordered fashion. And on the next slide, this is statistical process control chart. It's a statistically valid way of telling whether or not your interventions have resulted in change over time. It can be done on STATA, SPSS, SAS. There are a lot of easy-to-use programs that you can use. You have to know which chart to pick and so forth, but it's not that hard. And this is the change in the rate of central line-associated bloodstream infections on a unit over time. You can see there's been a shift. A real shift, a statistically significant shift in the rate of that infection over time. It doesn't even have to be that complicated. On the next slide is a run chart. A run chart uses about seven rules that you can put on an index card that are statistically robust and valid rules for determining whether or not we're just undergoing random variation or whether real changes occurred. And here you can see the C. diff rate on a ward has definitely changed according to these run chart rules that anybody can learn. Anybody on your staff can learn these in about a half an hour, and they're really simple to apply. So as far as I'm concerned, you can use this on a piece of scrap paper with a little index card or something on your mobile phone and become a time-ordered improvement expert, time-ordered data improvement expert in a very short period of time. Next slide shows a study I did early on in my career. Actually, it was the first study I did on improvement, again, with a fellow and with a pharmacist. And this was simply to see if we could reduce the utilization of antibiotics for surgery from what was then, I know this seems like the time of the dinosaurs, but as you can see there in those kind of teal-colored bars, averaged around 4 to 5 days. This was a long time ago. At that time, the evidence said 48 hours is adequate. Now we know that a single dose is adequate. We didn't know it then. We simply had a antibiotic order form which specified that for prophylaxis, it was 48 hours. for empiric therapy, waiting for culture, 72, and for a infection you actually document and treat it, the order had to be reconsidered at 7 days. And we instituted that, and as you do with any improvement project, if somebody doesn't want to play by those rules, fine. So we had an orthopedic surgeon who said, I'm sorry, I do cancer surgery on osteosarcoma. I don't see any data about that. I want to have it my way. And we said, just write an order for 7 days. If that's what you think you want, there's a default there. You don't have to follow the automatic discontinue. Just write the order so we can understand why and what you want to do. You can see here that there was a dramatic shift, and I apologize. This is before I knew much about Deming and the model for improvement. It's a before-after analysis. You should slap my wrist for this, but I was young, 1981 was when this was published. But you can see a dramatic shift in the use of antibiotics for prophylaxis down to 48 to 72 hours at most, with a few outliers, and that was that surgeon who did a lot of cancer surgery. Notice, again, a fellow is the first author, a pharmacist was the second author, and it was published in the most one of the two most prestigious journals in the United States, JAMA, and it was a simple quality improvement study. Next slide. It can get very fancy. I'm actually, given the time, I'm not going to dwell on this, but suffice it to say that if you look up that paper, you'll learn that this was the first study to demonstrate that adherence to gown and gloves precautions would reduce the transmission of infection in a hospital. This, I believe, and Elaine can correct me if I'm wrong, was the first rigorous study to demonstrate that isolation actually works. All this shows, and I encourage you to go to the reference, is that when we went from a compliance rate with precautions, isolation precautions, from around 37% to a sustained rate of adherence of 90%, the rate of infection fell fourfold, especially when the wards were teeming with snotty babies with respiratory syncytial virus infection. Notice where it got published. New England Journal of Medicine, which is the other prestigious journal, and the first author wasn't Don Goldman. It was Jean LeClaire, who was a microtech, who was the infection preventionist for our organization and did the lion's share of the work. On this paper, there also were several nurses. So you're getting the idea here that you don't see Don Goldman, first author, even though I was trying to get promoted at that time. Next slide. Now I'm going to show you an interventional study to improve, and I'm sorry, Elaine, hand hygiene. I know you're all bored to death with hand hygiene, but I want to make some points here. So there were four phases to this study in an intensive care unit. A baseline period to see what the baseline rate was. We introduced alcohol gel in phase two. In phase three, we use the alcohol gel or rub plus quality improvement with opinion leaders, systems improvement, everything I knew about quality improvement back in 2000. And then in phase four was maintenance period to see if the gains were sustained. So pretty simple study design. And we did this in three ICUs, the neonatal ICU, the pediatric ICU, and the surgical pediatric ICU. On the next slide, I don't want you to pay too much attention to the actual bars here and because the data is complicated. Basically, the bars display the three neonatal intensive care units, and the bottom graph shows the change over time for all of them. But what you'll notice, the only thing you need to notice here, is change is modest, and we never got much above 42% in any unit over the course of this study. So phase one, phase two, phase three, phase four, not a lot of change. We're right back where almost all other intensive care units were at that time, a miserable adherence to hand hygiene. We weren't even using the 5 moments. We were just saying, did you do hand hygiene before you went and after you went to see the patient? So pretty dispiriting. So why did this paper get published, which it did in a pediatric journal? Next slide will show you. We asked the question in sort of qualitative terms, did we do effective quality improvement? And I always encourage people to include qualitative inquiry when they're doing their improvement work. So first we asked them, were you satisfied with the gel? Only 45% were. Why weren't they satisfied? We got the money for this study from a manufacturer of a gel that wasn't translucent and it didn't smell so good and they didn't like the tackiness, on and on and on. So that was a mistake. We didn't really find out in advance whether this gel was acceptable to staff. Number two, they didn't think it helped with compliance. They thought it was sticky and uncomfortable. They didn't think we'd actually located it conveniently, even though we thought we knew best. We didn't actually follow people around to see where they wanted it. And then the posters, and I can't resist this, we use posters from Didier Pitet and Stefan Harbarth at the University of Geneva. Now, there aren't more famous people in hand hygiene in that world, in the world, and I know Didier has talked about these posters in international meetings. I've been there. They're great. I'm sure they work in Geneva. Maybe they work in your hospital. I had a sense, a gut reaction, that the humor wasn't going to play in Boston. And in fact, the humor did not play in Boston. And only 32% of people thought these posters were at all effective. We had an opinion leader. We picked the people we thought, these are the influencers. They're going to drive change. Only 24% knew there was an opinion leader. Wow, that's, what kind of opinion leader is that? And they didn't get any performance feedback. So if you don't do audit and feedback, how do they know if they're improving? How do they know changes in improvement? And I could go on, but the paper was accepted for publication because it was a good qualitative inquiry as to what went wrong in quality improvement. Next slide. A little bit about monitoring patient safety, the last project I'm going to talk about. We have many ways for monitoring whether or not harm is occurring, and I've listed them on the slide, but the one I want to talk about is on the bottom, the random safety audit. Now, what is that? So here's what a random safety audit is. I'm very attached to this innovation, and I think we should use it more. We got this from industry. Some of you may have heard of Paul Plisak, who's a great innovator in improvement, and he got this random audit from banking, which before we had deep data analytics and computers the way we do now, random audits were done on the records of the bank to see whether or not the processes were being followed. We made this real time at the front line. What this was to have a deck of cards, and each of these cards had a patient safety monitoring topic on it: hand hygiene, antibiotics discontinued, oxygen saturation monitor where it ought to be set in this neonatal intensive care unit. So there were cards just like in a gambling hall, and you could stack the deck. You could have 10 or 15 of these different topics you want to audit and put as many of those particular topics in the deck as you want, but every day you would randomly draw the card off the top, and that would be what you would monitor at every bed. And the nice thing about this is that the team is saying, wow, was the monitor where it should be today or not on this patient? And for each bedside, there's a checkbox. Either it was or it wasn't. And at the end of the day, you add it all up and you say, well, 30% of the time, the oxygen saturation monitor was where it should be set. So this is not only in real time, you don't add any staff to do the measurement, and you have social norming and behavioral change in action because people are in a team and trying to help each other out. So you can, based on what you find on these audits, you can decide to try something, do a PDSA cycle to improve it on the very next round. And so what can you do next Tuesday? Well, let's try a different way to approach this problem we found on rounds. So it systematically monitors a subset of error-prone points in a system that have the potential to harm patients. The items are selected randomly to be addressed either on multidisciplinary rounds or on a quick round during the day. You can pack the deck with stuff you really want to work on. We use 20 items developed by expert consensus that were related to safety in a neonatal ICU, and the 4x6 cards included yes-no data, and oh, by the way, on the back we put a trivia question like, does Don Goldman like sushi? So that kind of warms up the crowd a little bit and makes it kind of a fun game. So here are the results. 84% of staff participated in rounds. 100% agreed or strongly agreed that it improved quality and safety, which is amazing. 95% agreed or strongly agreed it increased knowledge of clinical guidelines and safety goals, and only 9% felt that it took up too much time. 91% said it did not add too much time to their work. Why? Because it's part of real work. If you want to do a change, an improvement project that involves measurement, force yourself to bring it into the system of work as it's actually practiced at the front line, you may find you improve your entire system by forcing yourself to incorporate data collection into the work. Next slide. Now, those are the examples from my own career. Before I tell you what these 10 tips are and reiterate some of the points I've made, let me just emphasize again that these innovative studies, these projects, were not because Boston Children's Hospital or Don Goldman are in some way better than anybody else. It just that we went about it with team spirit in the right way and with some care and scientific rigor. And I truly believe anybody can do that any place, any time. And I've tried to boil this down to 10 tips. And these tips tend to accentuate how you can use your improvement work not only to advance yourself professionally, but how to make that work more rigorous, be it for publication or presentation or even spread to your colleagues in other wards or hospitals or around the globe. So let's spend some time now with the 10 tips. And by the way, the only reason they're 10 is because the woman who helps here at IHI, Jane Rossner, said, "Do you really want 9? And so then I came back with 13. She said, "Well, do you really need 13? She said, "Use a big round number and consolidate your tips into 10. So, you know, good advice. Next slide. Tip 1, select projects that really will make a difference to providers and patients. Focus on clinically relevant projects that really improve the processes of care and you know are likely to be linked or tied to the outcomes that are interesting to the providers. So what do I mean by that? I could go to a urologist and say, let's look at your waiting times in the office and spend the next 3 months really getting them to be really good. And maybe I'd get a yes, because waiting times are important. They're customers, and they don't want to wait, and I don't think the urologist wants them to wait. But he's really interested. He does a lot of transurethral prosthetic resections, and he wants to know how are his patients doing after that. He wants to know, pardon my slang here, can they pee? Can they still perform sexually? Do they have any other, what was the underlying problem cured? Those are the clinical outcomes that matter. And so if you can start with a skeptic working on things that relate to the clinical outcomes that he was trained all of his life or she was trained all her life to do that also benefit patients, that's really better than working on something that doesn't have that immediacy. Then also think of a headline that your chief executive officer or medical officer would want to feature on the organization's website, or even better, do an interview with the New Delhi Times or the Boston Globe that would make an impact and bring fame and fortune to you and the organization. So if you use that kind of filter, you'll find you're working on more relevant projects that have a greater potential for engaging clinicians. Next slide shows tip 2. And you've seen this before, set bold, clear, measurable aims and a specific timeline for achieving them. And think about the fundamental advances that will measurably impact care and outcomes and engage clinical staff. So the setting of bold aims, of course, engages staff and energizes people, but be a little careful. Be bold, but also have a clear understanding of what's realistic. And even more importantly, understand what the best possible impact of the changes you're about to make are going to have on the outcomes. So let's take an example. If I decide some process of care in heart failure is going to really revolutionize whether or not patients are readmitted with heart failure, let's say getting a study of ventricular function, we tend to assume, because there was a study in the literature showing that getting this test was associated with better outcomes, P equals 0.001, that when we do it, the outcome will move. But remember, doing that one thing is only part of a whole suite, a whole range of things we need to do to really prevent heart failure patients from being readmitted, along, for example, with talking to them at a health literacy level that they can understand. And I can name 10 or 12 others. So if you expect that people will be thinking they're going to have a change in the outcome of readmissions of 20% because you've nailed getting ventricular function measured, they're going to be really disappointed. So understanding what in statistical terms is called the attributable effect of your change on the outcome of interest is really important. And if you're not clear about that, a lot of people are going to get frustrated with you very quickly. Tip three, assemble a multidisciplinary team that includes providers, stakeholders, and methodologists. And I would add now, and I don't know why I haven't revised the slide, and patients, if possible, tailored to the specific aim of the project. The patient part actually is really important. I've had whole study designs trashed because of something a patient said about, do you really think that's going to make a difference to a patient? Be agnostic with respect to the disciplines and titles that are in the room when assigning roles and rewards. The reason I emphasized who was the first author on all those papers is because the most unlikely person in terms of status may be the person who contributes the most, and they should be assigned an appropriate role and get an appropriate reward. If you're going to publish eventually, or you think you want to, define the roles and the authorships very early on, giving appropriate first authorship to people who don't happen to be physicians. In my experience, I've never had a paper adversely reviewed because a nurse, a pharmacist, a fellow, a technologist was at the top of that paper. People read the paper for the quality. I don't even want to be the last or senior author or the second author in a lot of these papers if they're better people to serve that role. You can't imagine, or you probably can, what it's like for a nurse working on a ward or a pharmacist be the first author in the paper in the New England Journal or the Lancet. It's life-changing for those people, and your next project will get a lot better buy-in when that word spreads. Next slide is tip four. Be creative in recruiting experts. And these can be from all the disciplines I have on this slide. These people are often craving an opportunity to be involved in clinical care. Here's an example. We did a study of the spread of chickenpox on a ward at Boston Children's Hospital. We were more than a dozen cases. It was very hard to understand how it had been transmitted. I won't go into detail, but we needed an aerobiologist. Well, they don't hang around the wards of Boston Children's Hospital. I looked online and I found, hey, there's an aerobiology group at the Harvard School of Public Health. That guy ran over to Boston Children's Hospital with his sulfur hexafluoride generators and all that stuff to study the air dynamics on that ward, and he ended up on the paper. And let me tell you, that was for him unbelievable. So even if they're not down the street at the Harvard School of Public Health, in this virtual environment, you can get that kind of collaboration from anywhere in the country or the world, for that matter, and people will be dying to work on a clinical problem to improve patient care or health. Tip five, next slide. Use the most rigorous study design possible without disrupting routine work. And I said this before, I'm going to say it again. Incorporate in the usual activities of the professional staff. And whatever you do, don't hold up work because you don't have a database. I remember to this day that we were reviewing the work of a relatively new hire at Boston Children's who was going to be dealing with pressure ulcers in children. We had a lot of chronically ill kids, and they do get pressure ulcers. She came to the first meeting, and I said, well, how's it going reducing pressure ulcers? Because she'd given this gorgeous slides and presentation. She said, I can't tell you yet because we're waiting for the database to be set up and put in use. And so this is literally true. I said, that's nice. Someday when you have a database, I'll be really happy. For now, here's a stick and a marker. When you make rounds to look at your pressure ulcer patients, or they make rounds on the wards, every time you see a pressure ulcer, just make a mark on this stick. And at the end of the week or the end of the month, collect the sticks and do a graph of the number of pressure ulcers you've seen based on the marks on the sticks. Well, I was trying to make a point, but in reality, incorporating the data collection in routine work and making it as practical as it needs to be is very important. Don't wait for that database. Next slide shows tip six. Do everything possible not to sacrifice data quality and completeness, however, and that means simple data collection tools that also simplify and increase the reliability of daily work. And checklists and standardized order sets are great examples. So the central line insertion bundle checklist incorporating daily work actually makes documentation simpler for the staff and also gives you the data you need to show improvement. Standardized order sets, as I showed with the antibiotic order form and in the study in Colombia, a very powerful way of bringing decision support into real work. And there are other ways as well, but try and make it simple. Next slide is tip 7. Take advantage of emerging certification requirements for clinical staff and make the improvement academically viable. So in the United States, we have requirements for maintenance of certification in various disciplines. And if you can get your work, especially collaborative work, to qualify for such certification, people will flock to it. And I work with the Vermont Oxford Neonatal ICU Collaborative, and the doctors and nurses and other people who are involved in that work, by virtue of being involved, get their maintenance of certification. Take work that you normally would regard as just being done because you have to be a good citizen. If you don't do it, somebody will scowl at you and not think you're valuable. But take that work, such as clinical practice guideline development and evaluation, and say, what little extra would I need to do to get this publishable, to make it CV worthy? And this is true of, regardless of your profession, because you all have pathways for getting tangible reward. There were at least two, there may be more now, clinical practice guidelines that we developed at Boston Children's that ended up in specialty journals of the junior faculty who worked on them. So you just have to press a little bit to do that. Next slide is tip 8. Don't assume you need external grant funding. So in the United States, people will say, well, it costs a lot of money. We have to apply to the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality or Medicare or the NIH to get money. Otherwise, we can't do this. Try and leverage institutional resources. If you're working in a smart institution, they will have small grants available to help rigorous people advance their work. But even if they don't, see what you can leverage. So, for example, the pharmacists at Boston Children's had to do work on reviewing the utilization of antibiotics. That was what they had to do as part of their normal work. How do you leverage that normal work and make it into something around quality improvement? I've given other mechanisms here. If you're in an academic environment, there's always a grad student hungering for a little barter. I'll do this free work. You put me on the paper. Tip 9, next slide. Be careful about the ethics. Now, I'm not going to have time to go into this today. At Boston Children's, and I think we're a little bit unusual in this regard, if you're doing quality improvement work that's designed to bring care closer to the accepted standard, you don't have to go through some fancy human studies or ethics review board. That's considered quality improvement. But remember, and this is the key point, poorly designed projects are unlikely to yield useful knowledge and, in my view, are therefore probably not ethical. How can you put anybody, be it a person in the staff or a patient, through any amount of work if it's not a good enough design to learn something? To me, it's appallingly wasteful and maybe unethical. And the other thing I'd like you to remember about the ethics of improvement work is that patients have a right to expect that unexpected consequences will be considered in advance and monitored. For example, let's say I set out at my hospital to improve compliance with isolation precautions for MRSA. Well, that's trying to bring care closer to the accepted standard. Who could argue with that? Let's go for it. Well, what are the unintended consequences? One is there are at least two, maybe three, pretty decent studies showing that when patients are on precautions, they get less high-quality care, less monitoring, maybe less appropriate testing. That's no good. You've got to anticipate that and ensure that the patients who are going to be put on precautions are getting equivalent care. Furthermore, every time you start a new project, there's what we call opportunity costs. You didn't do your priority matrix. You just did it because administration said, do it. Well, that's opportunity cost. Something else is not going to get done. I don't know many ICU teams, for example, that are sitting around waiting for more improvement projects. Quite to the contrary, they're likely to regard it as a burden and take away from something else they are equally likely to do. And finally, tip 10, anticipate publications. Remember the SQUIRE guidelines. The most important thing I can tell you if you're planning to publish is write the abstract before you start the work. That sounds bizarre, right? But if you are clear about what you want to do, you can write most of the abstract. First of all, what is the goal? What are the key methods? What are the key measures? What's your hypothesis? And if everything goes as expected, if your theory about this work was correct, and you're going to get the results that you expect, go ahead and write in, I call them dummy results, fake results, just to demonstrate that you know the results that are most important to you and that you have a way to measure whether they've been achieved and you stated your hypothesis. And then if it does work, what are your conclusions going to be and what are the implications and limitations? You can write 90% of that abstract in draft form, understanding it'll change, before you start the project. And it's people's eyes light up when they say, wow, now I understand what we're trying to do here and how we're going to determine if it worked. Be clear about the authorships. Every time I forget to be clear about the authorship, somebody is hurt, and they never forget it because they feel left out or neglected. And if the study does turn out to be quote-unquote negative, try and make the most of it. If you've done some qualitative inquiry, like we did in that hand hygiene study, hey, that was publishable because we were able to show that we failed and why we failed. One study that I'm sure Elaine's very familiar with was published in the New England Journal of Medicine. It was a huge randomized trial of MRSA screening. The study showed no effect, but because we were able to show why it didn't have an effect and to try and point the way to better studies in the future, even the New England Journal accepted it. So those are my tips for the day. Why don't I close and see if Elaine has any points she wants to make or questions.
Great. Thank you, Don. We've got about 3 minutes left, which is just perfect. And I have to say first that I couldn't agree with you more about the ethics of improvement, that if we use people's time, patients and staff's time, and we do a lousy job, then to me, we haven't learned anything, and it's just not ethical to waste people's time and resources like that. And I say that as an IRB chair as well. Some IRBs are still old-fashioned and expect that everything you do that might possibly be published has to go through the IRB, and that's still kind of an iffy issue. But I actually want to get back to a couple of the things that you said. One is that one of the things you suggested I ask, I think you already answered, and that is how can people who aren't in an academic setting benefit from this kind of approach? And I think through the whole talk you've given examples of the how actually a lot of what's done is not necessarily done in an academic setting. So I think that's great. But I was really excited by your random safety audit. And what's so nice about that is that it's nice that it's random and not planned. For example, now the, quote, secret shoppers, which are secret for about 1 microsecond with hand hygiene, they're expected, and so staff change their behavior when they come. But the fact that it's random and you don't sort of pick out one thing to focus on makes a lot more sense in terms of feasibility, but also in terms of potential effectiveness, because you sort of catch things along as they go. So are you still doing that? I'm just curious.
I don't see patients as of a year and a half ago, but I'm told that it's still being done at Boston Children's. And even more promising, we adapted it, and another neonatal ICUs are doing it as well. So it hasn't spread as quickly as I'd like, which is why I made such a big point of it here. But we did then adapt it for use as a random waste audit. So a lot of folks are interested in reducing cost and reducing waste and overuse in their wards. And it can be used in exactly the same way. We had, I think it was 20 or 30 intensive care units use the same tool, the same method, but this time they were looking for overuse of antibiotics, or they were looking for was the line removed when it should have been. All about waste, especially you can imagine in newborns, getting needless radiology was a big thing, or needless blood draws. So you can do it on almost any issue of quality, cost, and value. And I don't know the mechanism for this telecast, how this happens, but anybody who decides to experiment with this, who's listening to this call, I would love to hear about how it goes, because the hardest thing is to have what you're convinced is a pretty cool idea and to find it's hard to spread.
No, I agree. It seems to me that of all the things you talked about today, that is not only maybe one of the easier ones to start with, but also one of the more exciting ones. And I'd love to see that spread around. Two more slides, and I want to point out to you the upcoming conferences. They all look pretty exciting, as they always do. So be sure and get those on your calendar. And then lastly, thanks to the Teleclass Education patron sponsors that are listed on the last slide. So to all of you, go forth and do some random audits. Bye-bye.
Bye, everybody.